Good morning, everyone. Lovely to see you all here. My name is Anna Ambrose, and on behalf of Design Centre Chelsea Harbour, I'd like to wish you a very warm welcome to our Conversation in Design series. Before we begin, please can I just ask everyone to turn off their mobile phones. Thank you. So to our conversation this morning, past, present, future, reimagination and renewal. I'm very pleased to introduce our moderator, writer Charlotte Abrahams, and she is joined by three leading advocates from the worlds of design and architecture. Jonathan Tuckey, a leading figure for remodelling and transforming old buildings for modern uses. Edward Bulmer, an interior designer who specialises in the reorganisation and redecoration of historic buildings. And Rabbi Hajj, who is a passionate advocate of what he calls quiet architecture, where he repurposes existing structures with intelligence and subtlety. Please do join me in giving them a very warm welcome.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here this morning to discuss this issue of how architects and designers reimagine the past to create a dynamic present and future. It's something I think is a very important issue for our times. And to have such an expert panel to discuss it, I think is going to be a real treat. I thought we'd just start by letting each of them introduce themselves to you and give a quick sketch of their practice. So, Edward.
Thank you. I guess you'd call my work tickling up stately homes. They are stately partly because they're mainly inherited, but also because they're usually in a state. And they're in a state because they're far too big to cope with, or because there's no land left to support them, or frankly because they function so badly that they need to be made fit for another generation. And that has given me a career. And the reason I got into that was because I studied history of art at university. And so by staying in the stately home, historic home area, it allows me to do quite a lot of curating, which I love as well. And often what I find, I'm just looking at some gates there, not often asked to do gates, but I realise that a lot of the same disciplines that allow you to create as an architect or as a blacksmith or as a plasterer or as an interior designer all stem from the same discipline. And so I find it endlessly creative, even though it would appear something of a straitjacket to many people.
Thank you. Jonathan?
So my name's Jonathan Tuckey. We have a studio that we think of as changing old buildings into new ones. So I don't think of us as specialists in one building type, but what I think is common through all the work that we do is we always start with something and transform it. And quite often that is transforming from a building type to another building type. So people come to us with a deconsecrated chapel or an old bank or an old warehouse or maybe even a tin shed, and then it's those things that they arrive at our studio with, and they say we would like to turn it into, and it could be we've made bars, we've made restaurants, we've made hotels, we've made a lot of houses, but it's normally changing the use from one type to another type, and it's that I think is that's what I studied anthropology rather than architecture, and I find it very interesting to look at a building to understand how it's speaking, and to hear what the client is trying to get out of it, and find a way to put those two things together, those two characters together. So the pictures of ours that I think will come after Edward's are all, which I've tried to put them so that there's a black and white of before and a colour one of after, so you get a sense of what we started with, whether it's a ruined this and that, and what we then turned it into.
They will come. They will catch us up. Thank you. Rabbi.
Very good. Well, I am an architect and interior designer, so I do architecture and interior design. And I take projects how they come. And I have noticed something that was kind of a link between all the projects that I have been working on, is I like the patina of time. And in fact, very early I started working on big, massive industrial projects and other architects' practices. And then when I branched out on my own, I kind of fell into the interior by accident. I became more recognized as an interior designer. But what I do as work is a mix of sociology, anthropology, a little bit knowing about the history of the building that I'm working with, but also mainly the story of the people that are going to be the end users of the building. And then there's something that which became a link in my work, which is the admiration of the patina of time. So maybe as in a contrast to what Jonathan and Edward do, I kind of don't tend to... They do an amazing work on looking at the history of the building and restoring it. I take things as they are, and I use them as the sign of time and the specific style, the departure of style that I want to work with. So I like contrast and the contrast of the contemporary with the old. And the old saying that I'm old and I am basically have seen a lot of lives passing by the building. And I like to preserve this and readapt it for new stories.
Lovely. Thank you. So I wondered first, really, what as designers and architects, you felt your responsibility was to preserve existing buildings. Perhaps if we'd start talking about historic buildings, so Edward, you've got a lot of experience there. You know, what responsibility do you have to look after the heritage without lapsing into sort of nostalgia and that thing of preserving things in aspect for the sake of it?
It's a good question. I mean, the obvious answer is that there is a legal responsibility because we have a framework that nationally qualifies a building for protection, so that the listed building system. It's only actually about 500,000 buildings, like 0.01% of our building stock. Really? So anyone who says, we shouldn't protect these listed buildings, just tell them that it's only a tiny amount. And I guess that my focus is not saying venerate this building because it's old. Mm-hmm. It's about this building has been useful for hundreds of years. It's a bit pathetic if we can't make it useful for another few hundred. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of my clients have a head start because they haven't had to buy their building. And they probably have a lot of lovely things to adorn it with. But believe me, I've seen plenty of them live incredibly impractical, uncomfortable lives, over-venerating objects. And I don't actually think that breeds a sense of joy in conservation or actually an inducement to imbibe the next generation with that sense of care. So that's the responsibility I feel if I feel anything. But it comes out of my own love of old buildings. I'm not saying that that's what everybody should believe. But I think that if you do believe it, you feel a responsibility about how to enthuse others to do the same for you after your time, or to do the same at the same time as you, so that we don't have to fight, you know, with the Treasury for VAT exemption on historic buildings. It should be so feckin' obvious, if you'll excuse my mention, because old buildings enrich our lives. You know, I don't need to question that. I know it. Right. I just know it. You know, and there are a small number of them, so that small number do need to be looked after creatively.
And can you, and how much can you sort of interfere with the structure inside? You know, do you feel you need to leave layouts the same? Do you need to leave all the wood panelling? You know,
I think I would argue you can do as much as you want if you're doing the right thing.
Okay.
All you've got to do is do the right thing, design the right thing, and advocate it properly. Most of my houses would be grade 1 or grade 2 star. Actually, that is a lot less difficult, if you like, than a building that's grade 2. That sounds odd, but that's because grade 1 and grade 2 star applications have to be referred to what's called the statutory bodies. And they are like the Georgian Group or the Victorian Society or the SPAB. They know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So you have a proper panel of judges.
Right.
So you're not going to submit something that you know won't get past them, unless you're the adversarial type who feels you can just, you've got a client who just wants to throw money at it. But that's rare, I think. Grade two is done under what's called delegated powers, which means it's your local council. And very few local councils have the resources, frankly, to have an adequate size team, let alone an adequately skilled team. So you can often get bogged down with those, I do appreciate, no matter how good your plans are.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do either of you have experience of working with these historic buildings?
Yes. Yes, I commissioned actually a historical architect to do a report on the building, just to be able to dismantle it and go to the conservation officers and tell them, look, this is not what we're going to do, we're going to do something else. So, challenging them.
Okay.
And actually, I have a technique, is talking to them about how horrible it's going to be with the ideas of the client. So, maybe we should find a compromise. It always works. So, so it's a good technique, huh?
I remember.
So I think it's a conversation, you know. We should not be completely scared of these guys who hide behind big, massive books, plenty of nice pictures,
yeah.
And then, you know, restoring for restoring. I think this, there's a very small detail here in this house, for example, in New York, where we kept the brick kind of sticking out in the previous pictures. It will come back, probably. We kept the brick sticking out because it was the chimney flue. And the idea was not to completely wipe out this, you know, the story of this accident, which came out when we were kind of stripping out the building. But it's part of the conversation, it's part of the narrative of the building. Mm. And I come from the background of preserving and wanting to defend craftsmanship. So a bricklayer is as important as an amazing gilder or a plasterer. So there is some, in some of the pictures of my project, you see the contrast of a very kind of a clean interior, but also with a rough brick wall on a very ornate plaster cornice. And I think there is as much importance in noblesse in the workmanship of a bricklayer than a gilder or an upholsterer or anything. So, in fact, of course, I'm not going to completely aggress the conservation officers by telling them we're going to demolish this and start again. On the contrary, it's just preserving it and basically kind of redirecting it into modern living. Mm-hmm. And it does work all the time. By the way, in 19 years working in the UK, I never had one planning refused.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
And the technique is you listen to both. You listen to the conservation officers, the planners, and you listen to your client. And your work is to try to find, you know, to balance between both and come up with the right result. It's not all about square footage and square meters. It's about the functionality of the space, and this is what we design. Mm. The functionality of the space, and then the little ingredient that you sparkle on top is the aesthetic, which makes you forget about the functionality of the space.
Okay.
This is all what I have to say for today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And what about just the idea of just reusing existing buildings? So they're not important historically, they're not beautiful, but you know they are there already. I mean, you do a lot of this kind of work, don't you, Jonathan? What?
I think that if you think the city, in a sense, the city is just a big organism which is constantly being reimagined by people doing this, whether it's by people who ask us to do it or whether just people doing it themselves.
Yeah.
It's a kind of innate form of us adapting the things that we live in. And I think I think part of the delight in the jobs that we do is when someone comes to us with a building that doesn't look immediately attractive, it doesn't have that the listed status, and it's about finding the thing in it that's very beautiful. And I think it's, Ravi was using the word stripping, you strip back something and then you find it. I think that's how we normally start a project, is we go into this leaking sort of pigeon-filled shed, and you actually start to, how beautiful is that brickwork? Is there a lovely ceiling above the above that, the boarding? Is there something in there that is of beauty that we're going to celebrate? And then those are things that we're going to persuade the client or show the client in a different light that are worth adorning, showing off, and then layering something new next door to it. And I think that's often the most exciting part of the beginning of a project, is trying to find a way to fall in love with that space that someone's come to you with.
And why should we fall in love with it rather than knock it down?
Well, I mean, there's on a kind of purely emotional level, it's a very lazy solution just to knock it down and come up with something. Yeah, maybe no better, or maybe certainly not necessarily going to last any longer. But I think there's obviously an important environmental impact. The idea of just knocking down something that's doing a job, rather than stitching it back together and adding to it, is the environmental argument is very strong for that. I know that if you put, people might have heard of passive houses where there's a new building standard that you can build a new building and it can perform to a certain energy criteria, which will always beat an old building because it's made today. But there's an analysis done on the whole of the Grosvenor estate where if you just take one of those listed buildings and you do as much as you can to the insulation of the interior and to its heating system, and you also count the energy that is already there, the bricks that are already there that you'd have to take away, it would take a passive house 60 or 70 years to even get to to its embodied energy carbon usage. So they are very, it's an environmental solution, what we're doing, as much as an emotional solution. And the other thing that we were talking about behind the screen earlier is it's a much more interesting dialogue, because you have these constraints that you've got to work with. So it's an exercise of collaboration, because things get in the way and you've got to fit things around things. And I think that makes the spaces that you come up with more interesting as a result of having to fight with them rather than just having a blank sheet of paper.
And do you think that, because it seems to me, and I mean, you would know much better than I really, but it seems to me we don't do enough of repurposing. The instinct is to knock down. Is it because it's difficult?
Well, I think there's the VAT system that Edward said is absurd. That people have come to us saying, can we just demolish it because I save VAT if I build a new building?
Really?
Yeah. So every refurbishing, you pay VAT. New building, you don't pay VAT.
Demolition, you don't pay VAT.
So some people say, just knock it down because I don't like it, just because I want to save money.
You pay VAT also on listed buildings before you had a reduced VAT on the listed buildings. So the tax can also influence decisions. But there's one element of, to answer your question about why is it more interesting not to demolish and rebuild. There is, when it comes to residential and private clients, if they buy a property, a specific property, it's because it tells them the story. So the image that you have in front of you the day you're going to go and make an offer or pay for to complete is what you see. So unless you have an amazing, completely like a fantastic vision on what the place would be after you demolish it, then demolish it. But if the charm of the place made you take the decision of buying, so how can you preserve the charm? So forget about the history, forget about the historical way, it's the story behind the building or the provenance of the, you know, it's about what appeals to you at a certain time. So if you imagine, for example, there are some images actually coming out here. This, for example, an example of it's the orangery, which was broken, demolished, and we put a swimming pool, which was heated. And in this, behind the orangery, there's this brick wall. And I used to go there once a week when we were redoing the brick to basically tell the builders to stop cleaning the brick, to keep the patina that was telling the story to my client and to me, and to keep this kind of spirit of the place. Of course, we kind of subdivided it. You have a gym, you have an area for changing, so the functionalities are there. But the charm of the place has to be preserved. So I look at it only from the aesthetical point of view. Then, of course, you have the narrative behind, and you have also the justification of what is a good wall to keep, what's a good feature to preserve and restore, which comes into play, of course. I take it in a kind of face value, and I think that the patina of time is as interesting, from my point of view, is more interesting than bringing the best craftsman to make a perfect restoration as if it's brand new and shining. Mm-hmm. You know, it's for me, if you put, when I used to go and buy as a teenager furniture from the flea market in Paris, I preferred the battered chair and desk than the one restored for maybe half the price. So it's it is the patina of time, but also my approach is that you are basically keeping something historical, not only because of your research, but because of people who used this place before you. So it's kind of respect for other owners and other users that you're kind of extending, and you are basically barely putting your imprint on the place just to make it functional and useful for you, and then keep it and pass it on a generation. Mm-hmm.
But there are situations, I mean, I totally agree with that, and I think there are certain materials that you come across and you think have got a great deal of beauty that you want to hold on to. But equally, there are plenty of situations where you go into a building where the wall is ruined, there's water pouring down it, and at that point, we have a decision to make. Are we going to make it look like it's been there a long time, or make it look like it's new?
Yes.
I don't think there's a right or wrong, but invariably, at that point, you have to make that judgment of, am I going to go down the route of reproduction?
No, there is a right. There is a right or wrong. The right thing is not to create a pastiche and copy, from my point of view. So if the wall has to go because you cannot rebuild it, or the plaster has completely, blown out, and then you have to replaster it if you want to kind of have it. You are not going to fake the age of it. At the contrary, take the plaster out and keep the brick there with the marks of the water. There you go. This is kind of a decision. If it was, or take the bricks out, reuse them somewhere else, and you know that these bricks come from that wall that you have kind of respected and gave it a new life. Mm-hmm. So this is my point of view. I just wanted to kind of come up with challenging.
I disagree with you. I think that pastiche. I see that there's two ways of. Forever, there have been two ways in which people talk about these things. They either talk about a kind of old and new approach. It's a Ruskinian. It's the ruin, and then something glass and very contemporary next door to it. Or they take the approach that is working in the style of. Mm-hmm. So it might not be. Pastiche is a curse at the moment, and everyone says, "Oh, pastiche, you can't work in that way." I actually think pastiche. There's a lot of merit in the idea of copying. Copying is very interesting, and I think that it's almost impossible in our job not to do a bit of both of those things, mm-hmm. because if you find a ruined old wall, the chances are there's bits of it that you need to put back together before you put that brand new piece of glass next door to it. So the bits that you put back together might well look like they've always been there, because you might be picking up the old stones. You might not be putting in brand new, clean-cut blocks. So I think, even though we talk about these things as these two different camps, we are invariably moving from one to another in our day-to-day work, and it's impossible to avoid it.
What I totally love about this is that this is two architects talking. Architecture is a very old profession, and of course it's a greater profession than interior design. The lovely thing about interior design is it's much simpler. We're just trying to make places comfortable, And they can be comfortable to the eye, or they can be physically comfortable. But it would never occur to me that compromise wasn't part of creativity. And there's no old building that's really of only one date.
No.
And there are plenty of old buildings where actually we worship one phase of that old building. Yeah. Zion Park, where you're probably all going to bypass as you go to decorate. Zion Park is a fantastic, fantastic building of, everyone would say, you know, the Adam era, but of course it's not at all. And that's what's, I think, so special about old buildings, to touch on what these guys are saying, is that there is so much human endeavour in their creation, but then also the habitation. And so someone was doing interior design before interior designers were made, dreamt up, and it was the people that lived in the buildings. Mm-hmm. And some of their interior design was interior design, but most of it was just form following function. And that's what I love about working in old buildings, is that I've yet to be presented with a kind of design problem, putting in a kitchen or putting in a bathroom or some modern need that hasn't actually been solved in some way in parallel in the past. They are immensely instructive, I find. And I had a cousin who set up a lovely charity, or lovely for its name, called the Friends of Friendless Churches. And he was a rather dogmatic man, I have to admit, but he said that we must preserve every church because it's not just stone or bricks and mortar. It's an act of worship. And I think that speaks to what Rabbi is talking about, us remembering the craftsmanship. Nevertheless, I would say that there are elements of craftsmanship for which replica is fine, a fibrous plaster cornice, for instance, but elements where don't bother, you know, like an old master picture.
Right.
But give it a new frame. But, yeah. You know, so one is constantly thinking about, if you like, the status, I suppose. And my approach is probably much more restorative than these guys, because I suppose I'm trying to re-establish the design intent. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to create a melange of probably a great many periods, along with a lot of practical need, mm-hmm. along with a nod to why this is an important building, all in one pot. And my only answer to that is to create a sense of harmony. So you have to get all those things talking to each other.
So you wouldn't? Would you put something very contemporary into one of these spaces?
Oh, sure, sure. But how do you choose a good contemporary thing?
In the same way, yours, which had it's a blue space and had this metal framed light with the sofa.
Uh-huh.
That felt like a very much a collage of now and then, and
it's a space of 2004. But actually, it's very conservative. I mean, interiors are getting much more exciting now, and clients of my type are getting much more interested in our area. It's called the Chatsworth effect, where, you know, you're able to combine amazing old possessions with you know, Lucian Freud's and Edmund de Waal's and modern sculpture, and it's done with chutzpah. It's not actually done by conscious curating. In fact, it was just done by some confident people,
which was how
living in their house.
It seems to me somewhere along the line we lost the confidence to do that and thought, gosh, no, we must be kind of reverent to this period. No,
and so great architecture will happily accommodate good new contemporary furniture. But it's actually a test for the good new contemporary furniture, in my view.
It is. And I think the good contemporary furniture or the good contemporary art should be at the same level of quality as the old envelope that is kind of, that is containing them.
Yeah.
So it is, you are speaking the same language. So there is contrast in style, which creates a new style, but also they have to be at the same level. They have to come from the same kind of quality of pedigree. So this is what I think is interesting in our time now, is that the Chatsworth House or, you know, any contemporary magazine, now you have the big contrast between the old and the new. But there is The patina, I defend the patina of time. The patina of time, like for example this wall in the Raflax Hotel, for me, taking off 6 layers of wallpaper was an act of design.
Yeah.
Keeping the wall as it is with all these kind of leftover of plaster and paint, etc., was an act of design. So I kind of designed the place to give it its character. Mm-hmm. But also you can see through the layers and the time. If we want to kind of look at what Edward, for example, is doing, I put the craftsmanship that he uses in restoring an old building at the same level as finding an amazing young designer who has the most beautiful idea or using new technology is the same thing. So it is about the quality of the intervention and not necessarily the style of the intervention. It's more the quality and craftsmanship, which in fact is coming back. It's defending craftsmanship is an act of design and an act of... there are plenty of different... Actually, I did a presentation in Shanghai a few months ago, and I was telling... It was the first time in Shanghai. There's massive towers which are going to probably have a lifespan of 20, 25 years. They're going to demolish them and build something else, you know. And my presentation was, don't build anew, and please don't demolish. And in fact, you have plenty of styles or plenty of ways of doing this. So you have the juxtaposition. So the old that you preserve and glass or metal, very contemporary element that comes from it. So you have this contrast. You have the mirroring. You have the building which is old and you have the new which is kind of trying to mimic the old but with the same shape but with different material. You have the what I call in praise of absence. It's the element where you see, you kind of guess that there used to be a building on this wall that has been taken out, but it wasn't replastered and repainted and the story of it is wiped out. It's there, so the praise of absence, or reusing doors and windows from a different building and putting them in another building, which gives it a very special and strong character, but it's basically an homage to the old building. There are, I don't know, I classify them like 9 or 10 different ways of doing it. But today, I think it is a movement that we are living in. It's not only a kind of style, caprice of style, you know. It's a movement. We are all we all come from like maybe 20, 50 years of environmental, political debate and fight to preserve the planet. The environmental element of it is kind of prerequisite now.
Yeah. Do you think that is felt though beyond? I think probably just a sector of the architecture community. It seems to me that you're absolutely right. This is a really urgent issue that we have. You know, we have a terrible housing crisis, but we're not short of buildings. But that doesn't seem to be a debate that's happening very widely.
Yes, well, because the contractors and developers, they just want to keep the machine running. You know, it takes different skills, it takes different people, different sequences, it takes more time, not necessarily more expensive, actually, but it takes attention. So people don't want to have attention, they just want to cookie cutters, just get on with it and move on. So you get what you have now, which towers that are demolished. When you build in a rush, you have crisis, like, sorry, we're going to bring it up, Grenfell Tower, kind of cosmetic approach to a building that should not exist and should have never been built anyway, regardless of the building control and all the kind of fire control. Regardless of this, it's a building that should have never been built from the start. Mm. So now we are actually facing a new housing crisis. Yeah. I don't know if you have an idea about how many homeless families there are in London. Say a number. 50,000. Yeah. This makes 300,000 people homeless. So how are you going to house them? Sorry, I thought you wanted us to talk about aesthetic.
No, I do. I think it's really interesting.
It's the last 10 minutes.
How are we to
I'm going to rush and build things in a rush with these contractors and builders who tell you, well, we have a technique, we're going to do it for you, and it's going to be permanent. No, I think we have to find temporary housing, look at the real architecture and the housing, the permanent housing that we're going to build, and do something that would take us 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years to resolve while we find temporary housing for the 50,000 now, and build something that is has sense, have a sense of community, have will age well, and will be very kind of honestly and proudly transmitted to the future generations.
I don't know if this is what Johnny sees, but to me, the best way to get 10 old buildings restored is to restore one really well. It does seem to have a kind of an effect. And, we were talking earlier about, I've certainly seen in America how really proper restoration of buildings has been used without question as a force for regeneration. And it happens because you make a nice place to live. It's simple stuff. And it's not necessarily architects who are going to solve the housing problem. We've just got a fucked-up social system that doesn't really want to solve it. I mean, you know, politicians could do far more if they wanted to, but they don't. Look at the amount of new housing has been produced in London. Is that to solve the housing crisis? No, not at all.
I agree with you.
I think it's a different issue, to be honest.
I mean, we're doing two small projects, one for Southwark and one for Hammersmith and Fulham, which... It sounds like they've asked us. They haven't. We've actually told them we're doing it. We've just been walking around. A lot of the people in my studio live in Southwark, and our studio's in Hammersmith and Fulham. And we've just been walking around two wards, photographing and suggesting where they could add small, you know, 4 units, 3 units, actually improve the environment, because there are these gaps that aren't doing anything. They somehow feel left over. The density would be slightly increased, but in somehow the kind of city plan would be improved. And just suggesting to them, you know, in this ward you could get an extra 200 units, in that ward you can get an extra 15 units. And it struck me, just as an exercise that we do in our lunchtimes in the studio, that actually how much possibilities there are, how many possibilities there are with these small interventions.
And this is to buildings that are already there.
To buildings or to plots or on top of, next door to, adding. Yeah. In the way that we approach our private work, it's sort of taking that approach to the community or the wards that we live in. And it's completely different to their approach, which is just sort of cut down a tower and build two more towers, which is going to... You're only just pushing the problem on.
And are they
for 50
receptive?
Years. They are very receptive. Yeah, they haven't paid us at all for it, but they're very receptive to the idea. And so in a way, it just feels like the beginning of a conversation... Yeah. For us, it's been fascinating just to see, uncover how many possibilities there are in an area, to then start to think, well, I'm sure you could replicate this across London.
Yeah. I'm doing the same approach as you. Actually, you see, we architects, we kind of do some projects which are self-funded. I'm working on a temporary building system with a UK building company to develop a system which will be used in brownfields or spaces that are waiting planning applications, etc. And we are actually doing a prototype which will be which will have a test. We'll test it in Sion Park, by the way.
I'm not doing this. Sorry. I'm not doing this, and I'll tell you why I'm not, because I've tried it, and the problem is not clever architects or builders' input. The problem is, how does that person, even if they're married and their wife is, or husband, partner is working, how does that person get a deposit?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Get to
what we built a wooden house. It sunk six tons of carbon. It used half the amount of water of a normal house. It used 50 tons of wood. It was clever. But I realised that that wasn't the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, the technology has been answered. The problem is that we're not releasing the land in the right way. We're not valuing how we introduce younger people into the property owning class. And we've got to somehow encourage that. And that's not, I think, the job of architects. I really think that's the job of us people, to want more neighbours and the right sort of neighbours, and to realise that the school will close if there aren't any young families. It's very simple stuff, but it's socially driven. And I think that when architecture is socially driven, it's successful. And I work for people who, without question, make life hard for themselves. They inherit these buildings, but something makes them want to keep mm-hmm. them going. Mm-hmm. They consume vast amounts of energy. They're ridiculously large very often. They have to share them with the public. There is no such thing as privacy in these mm-hmm. buildings, because mm-hmm. either a staff or some gang of people have to inhabit them with you. But they go on doing it because they go into their rooms and they feel the presence of ancestors or other people, or they actually love it and just want to share it with people. Mm. And I think that when we're denigrating modern building, and I'm along with you in doing it hard, I think what we're denigrating is not the aesthetics, although that's what we usually do. It's just that we have not yet worked out something that had been worked out perfectly well in the past, is that if you have a proper social arrangement where you've got small business and families and need an infrastructure to a slightly larger town sometimes, that works. But we've centred everything in London now, and mm-hmm. we've given most of London away to Chinese businessmen.
Well, there is a big reason for that, which is impossible to rework the other way around. It would take another century. It's the exodus from rural areas to the cities. But you said something very interesting very early on.
Well, thank
is
you.
Yes. It is.
I want to
recenter on aesthetic, and I think you said something which is it's important to do. If there is one building within a neighborhood that is restored and looked after, it's leading by example. This is what you meant. And I think it is important, even if, you have... It's maybe not mainstream to go ahead and kind of preserve old buildings, whether you want to do it for the aesthetic or you want to do it for the historical side. It's important to do it because you are completely convinced that this is the right thing for you, and this is the sensitivity that you have with the building and the connection that you have with the building. And if few leaders of taste do this, it will ripple down, and mm-hmm. you have people who will follow this. And I think we are working for leaders of taste, and we can see already kind of a little bit of a movement of people coming to us, say, I've seen this done at my mm-hmm. friend's house, I'd like to do the same, or maybe something different, etc. But there is now a real direction, which you have it from the client side, from people ordering the work, mm-hmm. And from the patrons and from the makers, from the designers, which are kind of linking. You have the will of keeping the memorabilia sometimes, but keeping the elements of history and connectivity that you have with your family rippling down from history of the location or of the family. And you have on the other side designers who are, and I completely support this, who are using discarded elements as noble material, and which now there is kind of a movement called upcycling.
Yeah.
So you have this on one side, designers who are, painters in the 90s who take boards and paint on them amazing masterpieces. They take scrap wood or discarded metal and make something amazing out of it. And I think there is this kind of movement from both sides of the patrons and the artists coming together to do something which is really interesting, which in 50 years we will remember as, I don't know what movement we will call, but mm-hmm. maybe is it could be called upcycling? Is it conservatism? I don't know.
And do you think, just before we hand over to questions, that in 50 years' time this movement, and I think I agree with you, will it have made a significant difference, do you think, to our built environment? Will more of us be living in repurposed buildings?
I say yes. How about you, John?
Yes, but I think we have always been doing it. So
right.
I think we're talking about it more, but I think this is something that's age old, mm-hmm. and it's just that we're defining it, mm-hmm. writing about it, having...
But we do it at a bigger scale because you have a little bit more people who are interested in the subject and capable of preserving and doing, not massive mansion houses, but small apartment blocks.
So do you think we will be building new, less, and repurposing?
Well,
more?
One thing you said when we were behind there earlier was what building type... Will we sort of need to scurry around for?
Yes, the equivalent of the Victorian
terrace. And I've been trying to think about it since then. And
yeah.
It's what I was saying to Charlotte before was that it tends to be the buildings that are the most unloved because they're then cheap and then people can get them and do something creative with them. And that was in the 50s, it was muse houses, they were garages and then became everyone wanted to live in a muse house in the 60s. And in the 80s, it was warehouses. No one wanted to live in a warehouse. Suddenly artists go in there, they make them nice and everyone thinks, oh, I'd like a warehouse. I think potentially the places that are the most derelict in our cities now are retail spaces because those streets are just nothing. You know, no one can sell anything anymore because they're selling it either online or in big shopping centres. And there's parades of often quite nice buildings. I mean, if you just moved in and you didn't do anything, it'd be awful because you'd be living with a big glass window onto the street. But somehow I think if a change of use to make that, you know, in good hands, converted in... showing a sort of typology
actually,
that you could live in it.
It's happened in the country. I mean, you know, I live in a village. There used to be three shops. Now they're all houses, and they've done really quite interesting things with what, you know, old shop fronts. Yeah.
So I think as a typology, they are probably cheap, and therefore people can afford to go into them. They're not getting any rent, not getting any business rates, and they could make quite interesting living accommodation with careful thought.
I think the other thing that we perhaps skirted around, haven't mentioned, is the use of materials. And I think that I hope that we are not going to forgive ourselves for the way we use materials now, the sheer wastage of resources, finite resources. And the joy of an old building, even when it's falling down, is that you can either continue the process or perhaps reverse the process. But all of those materials are entirely reusable. And the reason is because they were built with real understanding of what it took to get a building to stand up in the pre-technological age.
Yeah.
And if you want to reclaim 100 bricks from a modern house, forget it. But if you want to reclaim 100 bricks from an old house, you'll be able to, because they have been put together with lime mortar. Yeah. And that lime mortar is replicable. You won't save it itself, probably, but the bricks will be very easy to clean off and entirely reusable. And they've also been fit for purpose because buildings have to breathe like humans have to breathe, and they stand up that way so that damp doesn't reside. But they also help to control the atmosphere that we inhabit. And there's not enough talk about this at all. I mean, as you may or may not know, I've started a paint business.
Yeah.
There's only one thing that should be on the side of a tin of paint, and that's the SD value. Hands up anyone who's heard of the SD value. Gentlemen. The SD value is a measure of the passage of moisture through the material. And if paint doesn't allow, for instance, moisture through, or a plastic membrane, or a render, whatever it is, if it doesn't allow that, just think about it. Where does the moisture end up? And if it ends up inside the wall, it's literally undoing your building while you inhabit it. And it's crazy stuff. And if you put it that way, you wouldn't, of course, put your hand up and say, that's what I think you should do. But we don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you begin to look at buildings and architecture and interior design from material first, you're getting close to grammar. And grammar is where most of us start before we develop a vocabulary. And it will give you buildings that are ultimately flexible, actually. It means you literally can take the whole thing down and rebuild it if you want to.
Well, I think that is a very thought-provoking place to stop. I'm sure there are lots of questions. Anyone from the floor? Maybe.
Hi. I just wanted to say, as being a rather lesser building contributor to this debate, there are lots of, of course, far smaller buildings we're all beavering away at and trying desperately to put in to maintain the integrity of the place, the integrity of the pieces, and all those things. It's really interesting to hear what you had to say as the panel about this, and it's so heartening to hear this on the mega scale. It is clearly a much more difficult thing, I think, when you're dealing on small domestic houses where people simply don't understand, you know, the paint scenario, the breathability, and all those things that are so important, and it's taken time for it to come through in the last 10, 15 years. It's just you know, hooray, it's coming to the fore. So thank you, panel. It's really heartening to hear what you had to say. The only thing is, would you like to come and stop, you know, 3,000 monopoly buildings being put on the field next door to my house in the countryside, or at least if they were designed with some yeah. you know, feeling, it would be just marvellous, because that would make things so very much nicer.
Well, to pick up on your, or to turn this into a question, what I think is so sad for me as an eco-bore is what we're missing out on. The creative possibilities and potential of embracing ecological building and buildings that are fit for humans, for the planet, for health, for aesthetics, for the next hundreds of years is so exciting. And we're just letting those developers carry on with that tired old business model. They're sitting on the land because it doesn't suit them to release it, etc. Government simply is not interested. And I think it's very depressing.
It is an education, actually, that one would have. Anyone in this industry, whether interior designers, architects, developers, or even the contractors, they have to have an ethic, actually, in their approach. And the ethics should remember one thing is the same thing we're talking about, what our movement would be, you know. What will this building be in 50 years? You have to project yourself in time. You know, what's the average age of a building in the Western world? Is 90 years. We live now more than 90 years. So, you know, it's a question of kind of, we outlive our buildings. We need the buildings to outlive us. And I think this is the mission that we should have all, and all of our practices, is to try to make a building that will defy time and still be standing. And the best way is a mix of old technique. Why old? Because in fact, time has proven that they are good. You know, we have an industry which is built on verbal knowledge. It's not, you don't learn our business in books. You learn it in practical way. So you learn it with experience, with making mistakes and repairing your mistake. Collectively, we have made a mistake of building quickly after the Second World War or whenever we need buildings, and not think about what is going to happen in 50 years' time. It is time to think about it today. We have to design with time in mind. Absolutely. This is really what I would have to say for today, in fact.
Unless there's another question. Well, like right. Anyone else? Okay, well.
Yeah, we've done that.
Hi, and thank you very much for that. You all have such strong ethical sort of backgrounds and sort of the way that you deal with your projects. And I wondered, you're all working at a very high level of design and luxury projects. There must be times where you have ethical dilemmas with your clients when you're, you know, sort of expected to produce something that goes against what you really believe. I kind of wondered if you had any particular ones that, you know, that you could share with us, or and how you've handled them.
Name and shame.
You go ahead. You start.
It happens in small degrees all the time.
Yes, because we have to look after our reputation
too. And I suppose for an interior designer, it's different to being an architect, perhaps, because I'm asked to do old buildings, so I have to expect the client to expect that I know about old buildings. So take that as read. I should be able to sort out a Georgian house without thinking too much about it or having to go off and do endless research. But that's not the point. The house is not actually the project. The client is the project. And the client may not be one client. For instance, a husband and wife, you'll be amazed to hear this, but sometimes don't agree. So, you know, my role is about quietly getting on with sorting out the architecture, drawing attention to anything that I think is uncontroversial, probably, but most of all, listening to what the client's hopes for, and this has been said by everyone on the panel, what is the client's hope that the building will deliver to them? When done. And I've listened to a depressing amount of discussions about the client being told they can't have that, when I know in my head that but for a little bit of extra design time, a little bit of extra thought, a little bit of flexibility, they could have it. But if a person thinks that they don't want to give that extra time because they're not going to get an extra fee, I understand why why sometimes that doesn't happen. But ultimately, I mean, I'm lucky because probably the building will be judged on its facade and then after that on what I've done. But I'm not interested in the I call this the makeup, really. I mean, the real job of interior design is the kind of establishment of a proper well-being atmosphere. This building must be really healthy to live in because it's a happy place to live in, because it's a comfortable, practical family home, if it's a family home. And you don't get that by just looking at the architecture. You have to listen to a whole wealth of different stimuli.
Yes. In fact, you have to believe to live what you are preaching for. So it happened to me to walk away from projects when the client was refusing to kind of understand what we were advising him to do. Very, very rarely, I did walk away from a couple of projects in the past. But our job is to listen, as I said before, to listen and to kind of counterbalance what the administratively and historically you can do with the building, what's good for the building and what's good for the client, and try to educate the client in the process. So most of the time they listen to you, this is why they hired you. And if they don't listen to you, it means they didn't hire you for the right reasons, so you walk away. For the sake of the building, because the same thing, you know, the buildings are more important than us. They should remain longer than our lifetime.
Jonathan?
We haven't had that problem. I mean, we talk to people at the beginning, right? We just have a lot of conversations, a little bit like this, where we spend time in the building, we get to know them, they get to know us. So I think we kind of self-select one another, them, us, and us, them. So I think if they get the feeling, or we get the feeling, that we're not going to have a good 2 or 3 year relationship, essentially what these things take, we somehow seem to work that out at the beginning. So along the way there are tussles, but I don't remember an ethical one. I mean, there'll be tussles of the nature that we've both been talking about, and those are interesting for us to listen, explore, test, represent, and ultimately they will decide what the right thing is. But we haven't fortunately had a kind of difficult ethical decision to have to make.
Thank you. I think we're going to go with a lot to think about after this session. Thanks very much indeed.
Yeah, I'd like to say thank you to Edward, Jonathan, Rabbi and Charlotte for such a fascinating, actually very passionate discussion, debating their responsibility to preserve the old, find and celebrate the beautiful, respect the environmental impacts and appreciating the narrative of buildings and spaces. We've really appreciated your very personal perspectives on how you reimagine the past to create dynamic, intelligent spaces for the present and importantly for the future. So I know we could be here a lot longer. I think we'd love to be, but time has run out. So please do join me in thanking our panel. Thank you.